you know, me and my group, I've never had more staff than I currently do. And my emergency department has never had more doctors in it and never had more nurses in it. Yet I'm not able to necessarily achieve what I want to achieve. Private healthcare for NHS patients, we should be relentlessly reducing the waste within our own NHS services and seeing what resources we can save. If you get paid more to work in a supermarket than you do to look after our elderly relatives in a care home, then we're going to struggle to fill those spots. In systems where public healthcare is not an option, there are a lot of losers. I hope the NHS survives. It's got a huge amount of public support, but it can't survive without changing. Sum up in one word, challenging.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Edward Hartley. Ed is a consultant in emergency medicine and the Group Clinical Director for Emergency Medicine for the NHS University Hospitals in Coventry and Warwickshire. Ed, thank you so much for joining us today. It's wonderful to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. And particularly for your role, we're really grateful for your time. We know the pressures on the NHS at the moment. But can you just expand a little bit to begin with to tell us what is your role? You know, what do you do in the NHS?
So first and foremost, I'm a doctor. I went to medical school and graduated as a doctor about 19 years ago now. I moved around a bit and then I undertook specialty training in emergency medicine and have been a consultant in emergency medicine in Coventry for, this is my 10th year now. In addition to my clinical work, I have leadership and management responsibilities. And for the last 2.5 years, I've been the group clinical director for the emergency medicine group. All hospitals are managed differently, but my hospital has 7 clinical groups, and I'm responsible for the performance operationally, clinically, financially, and from a workforce perspective for emergency medicine, and that includes acute medicine, a number of urgent treatment centres. So I divide my time between seeing patients and then, you know, providing senior leadership to a team of about 800 at the moment, I think it is, looking after the needs of the patients who come to our hospital when they weren't expecting to.
It's quite a workforce to be the senior leader of. And actually, it's that senior leadership experience that you've got in the NHS that I think is going to be really interesting to hear about today. But I'm just interested, you know, we hear about the difficulties that the NHS is experiencing at the moment as a system, as an institution, and also that individuals feel. And would you say that with your daily, your weekly tasks, would you say that you love your job? Or is it, based on what it's like at the moment, is it a kind of a labour of a more enduring love for healthcare or for the institution?
I do love my job. I wouldn't do anything else. I think one of the beauties of a career in medicine is that it can change. There's a range of different things that you can pursue depending on what your interests are. I love what I do. A lot of doctors would hate to do what I do. You know, medical leadership isn't something for everybody. I enjoy the balance between leadership, management, and then clinical work along the side of that.
Okay, so can you give us a little bit more on the ground examples, really, of what you do in your role on the daily or on the weekly? However, you know, it's easier for you to talk about it.
Yeah, so a significant chunk of my work is still clinical, so that's seeing patients who come through the emergency department. I'm an emergency department consultant, and that's adults and children who didn't expect to need to come to hospital, but here they are. So that's a significant chunk, and that's both directly seeing patients, supervising the clinical team that are seeing the patients, and I've been providing a consultant opinion, and also managing the shop floor of the emergency department, making sure that we're appraised of the risk for patients that are perhaps waiting to be seen, that we're understanding where our sickest patients are, that we're cognizant of patients who might be deteriorating, and arranging admission or discharge for those patients. So that's a significant chunk. The majority of my time now is spent in leadership. So I am responsible for and accountable for the clinical performance of the emergency departments, and all that. So that's a significant amount of clinical governance, which might be incident investigation, reviewing deaths, managing risk, understanding where we're at with audit performance, etc. I have responsibilities to ensure that we deliver on budget. So I'm accountable for the budget of my group. I'm accountable for the performance of the workforce. And I have a team of people that help me with that. And I also help to set the strategic direction for emergency medicine within my trust, and then increasingly across the system that the acute trust work within.
And how much autonomy does an individual trust or the NHS universities that you oversee, how much autonomy do you have to set that direction?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think probably in medical leadership, it's common to think that it's the next level up that has the greatest degree of autonomy. However, I think actually within the role that I've got, I do have a significant amount of autonomy. The healthcare is, whilst the NHS is obviously a huge national institution, it's run primarily at a regional level through systems. Acute trusts generally are the largest partners within those systems. And so the acute trust has a significant say in what needs to be done and how to do it and how to spend the resources that it has available. And me in my role within the acute trust, I get to have a significant say in the direction of emergency care.
Can you just map out to us then the management and organisational structure sort of above and below you, if that's in any way the right terminology in terms of direction? Can you just lay that out a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's different from place to place, actually. But so I suppose my trust is, and all acute trusts are run by an executive team. And they report to a trust board of non-executives with a chair. Underneath the executive team where I work, we have 7 clinical groups, each led by a clinical director, which is what I do, alongside a director of nursing and a director of operations. Within each group, we have a range of specialties. So I'm an emergency medicine doctor, and so I will have a lead doctor and a lead nurse for emergency medicine. And then for acute medicine, which is especially within my group, or children's emergency medicine, or the urgent treatment centres, there will be other leads who will report into me. The trust works as part of a system, and the system, otherwise known as the Integrated Care System, or ICS, which is overseen by an Integrated Care Board. That board is made up of representatives from the acute trusts and also from general practice, from public health, and from commissioning. The integrated care systems will receive the budget for a region, and that budget will then be devolved out to the acute partners or to the community providers to spend in accordance with what the national NHS priorities or regulations stipulate we need to be spending money on.
Our listeners and viewers might typically, through various different news or media outlets, hear about what it's like to work in the NHS, or from a healthcare perspective. They might hear from nurses, they might hear from general practitioners, and then they might hear from sort of like the chief medical officer. Why is it important or helpful to hear from you today, in your position as the group clinical director? Why is that helpful for us to hear your experience as well?
My role bridges the gap between healthcare provision, so I'm doctor seeing patients, and I kind of know what it's like to have my boots on the ground and be on the shop floor seeing patients. So I kind of feel the pressures that you read about in the news, and I also am there delivering the care that people who might be listening to this or watching this would receive when they come to a hospital. So that's one of my perspectives. And then I'd have another perspective around overseeing clinical safety within the NHS in general, challenges we might have on a broader level, how an organisation might set strategic direction to plan effective services for the future.
Okay, yeah. That's a very helpful, very important perspective. From that perspective, where you've been on the ground working, you still are, and you've done that for, 20 years, and, you've got a really good experience in that area. From that perspective, how has the NHS changed since you first entered into healthcare practice?
I think the change is gradual. There's a range, so one would expect that in the course of 10, 15, 20 years, treatments, for example, would advance. And that, of course, happens. And with that comes improvements to patients' health, but also new challenges. Changes to the way the NHS is funded or the way that that funding trickles down to patients, changes how we plan the services that we provide. We have seen, there's a significant number of changes, I suppose, over the past 15 to 20 years. I think there's an increased amount of specialisation. So increasingly, doctors are trained to do a narrower work within a narrower sphere to perhaps a greater depth of understanding. There's been changes in the way that primary care is provided, changes in the way that social care is provided. There's knock-on impacts of those into hospitals, which is what I know most about. We've had huge challenges around unplannable events like COVID and how we recover from that. We have had changes in the way that what our workforce looks like, who makes up that workforce, and everything that comes with that too. It's a huge beast as the NHS, but it's not something that can stand still, and it is constantly needing to evolve to respond to risks that might emerge or new problems that need to be sorted out.
And do you think in general the movement that's happened in the NHS has been helpful in the way that you've suggested that structures have changed or different remits have changed, and there's just some particular barriers that are coming in that mean that it might be not working as effectively as it could do, or is there something overall the direction of the wind is not helpful for providing the holistic healthcare that it could do?
Some things are noticeably different in the last few years. I think one of the things I've noticed in the emergency department is how public health seeking behavior changes. When I started in emergency medicine in 2005, the types of patients we would see would be different to the sorts of patients that will come through the emergency department now. An example of that, I suppose, is how we provide what we would call primary care or urgent primary care. So that's patients who come to a hospital with something that could be treated by a doctor or a specialist nurse in a different setting. When I started my current post, we tried to set up a GP service within the emergency department. We couldn't make it work. We couldn't find the patients there. My hospital's few miles out of town, it's about a quarter of a mile down quite a long road, and you have to try to get there. And we found that patients would come to the emergency department with emergency department problems, so things that needed urgent treatment, or they would come to significant harm. That's something that's changed over the past few years. We now run 3 urgent treatment centres from my trust. I have an urgent treatment centre at the trust I could probably fill twice over because of the increased number of patients who present with lower acuity urgent problems, and that's to do with public health seeking behaviour.
Interesting. And what was the rationale initially for trying to make that change, where you saw ultimately in making the change it didn't work, people didn't use it in that way? What was the rationale in the first place?
If I remember rightly, I think that came from central NHS advice that emergency departments should consider putting these sorts of facilities in. And that's an example of the way that the NHS can work. We will pursue a service because it's nationally recommended without thinking actually locally, does this work for our population? I think we're getting better at that, and getting better at working out what works for our group of patients and trying to put something in that does work for them. Because, there have been very many successful provision of urgent care within A&Es for years and years in those A&Es where they've got that need. At that time, we didn't have that need. We do now. Things have changed.
And just for our listeners who don't know sort of Coventry and Warwickshire and internationally as well, how would you characterise the healthcare needs that are most predominant in your trusts? You know, what's Coventry and Warwickshire? What are the issues that we see?
So my hospital is a large tertiary referral centre. So that means that we've got all the specialists working there, neurosurgeons, cardiothoracic surgeons, plastic surgeons, you know, renal physicians, etc. And we serve a population, we serve the local Coventry population. Coventry's got about 450,000 people in it, but we serve a wider population of up to about 1.5 million for some of these specialties. Within my local area, there are other acute hospitals, and they will provide some of these services, but they won't provide all of them. So where I work, a fairly large urban area, but with one hospital, contrast that to other large cities, Manchester, Birmingham, London, Sheffield, Newcastle, places like that, you might find several acute hospitals within one area. So what it means is for the patients that I see coming through our A&E, we will see patients with from inner city areas. We will see a wide mix of inequality. We will see well-to-do people who've fallen off a horse. We'll see inner city problems, accidents occurring in warehouses. We'll see homelessness. We've got a large student population, etc. So I see a really broad group of patients in the hospital I work in. We are a major trauma centre, so we'll receive the helicopters and the ambulances from the large traumas that will happen in the surrounding region. And I think we serve a population about 1.5 million for that. If you went down the road to one of the other acute hospitals in the region, you would see a much more local population, and you'll see less of the patients who require super specialist care.
Okay. Now, if we draw on your experience from that particular region, but then have that in sort of conjunction with the national picture, what are the difficulties that you see at the moment? You know, the on the ground difficulties, the leadership structural difficulties, and if you can you say where that has come from, where those difficulties have come from?
It's been reported, hasn't it, several times over the past couple of years about the stresses and strains that's been felt within emergency care in the UK, and it's commonplace at the moment for patients to wait long times in emergency departments to be seen. The other thing that happens is when patients have been seen and we decide that they might need to be admitted to hospital, there can then be quite a long wait in an emergency department for a bed. 2004, the NHS introduced the 4-hour standard, stating that all patients should be in and out of an A&E within 4 hours. And that was initially set, I think, about 98%. That was revised down to about 95%. But up and down the country, it's many, many years since that 95% standard has been met. And at the moment, most hospitals are trying to meet a revised 76% standard against 4 hours. 10 years ago, if a hospital was only managing to see 76% of its patients within 4 hours, it would be an outlier in the national picture. And that would be, an example of a hospital probably that wasn't delivering as care as effective as it could do. And now the reality is that many hospitals are struggling. I suppose on a practical level, if I'm working in the emergency department and I have 40 available cubicles to me and I have 120 patients in the department that need to be seen, the ability to see those patients that are waiting is really difficult. I can only see a patient if I've got a space to see them in. I can only have a space to see them in if I can get a patient onto a ward. I can only get a patient onto a ward if I can get a patient out of a ward. So it all ties in with hospital occupancy. Very common for acute hospitals to be running occupancy in the high 90%, which I don't know, I've not worked in a hotel, but I imagine that if you work in a busy hotel, you probably don't aim to have your occupancy over 98% all the time and expect your rooms to be ready for patients to come, for paying guests to come into. So we have challenges with occupancy. With that breeds inefficiency. We have challenges around funding. I think not necessarily overall funding, but the way that funding comes down and how it's planned short term. And I think the net result of that is that we have a workforce that is struggling to be as productive as it can be because the working environment in which they're in is not one that allows them to be productive. that manifests as feeling under-resourced, and then resources coming in largely into the acute trusts as to solve a problem rather than to treat the root cause.
That makes sense. And just joining a couple of things together, you said, you know, that maybe not overall funding, but how the funding is used and trickles down is part of that sort of the causality of on the ground issues that experienced. And then previously, when you were talking about how the NHS had changed over the years, you said there had been changes in the way that that funding is presented to you and how it does trickle down. Can you go into that in a little bit more detail? How has that changed in terms of the funding you receive or how you receive it?
I suppose broadly speaking, there's, for a hospital like mine, there'll be two different routes of funding. It will either be payment by results, where a hospital will deliver X number of operations or X number of clinic appointments, and then we'll receive X amount of funding to support that. Or it might be block funding. So irrespective of the amount of activity they will deliver, they will receive a fixed envelope of funding and they can carve that up with a degree of flexibility. It's quite a lot of short-term funding in the NHS, so it can be quite difficult to plan. We often experience additional funding coming through in the winter, and that can land quite short term. We might not know that we're going to receive, sometimes in the region of a system might not know it's going to receive maybe a few million quid until 3 days before it needs to be spent. So that short term approach to funding inhibits our ability to do long term planning.
And I can see that might hit people across the country in your position very similarly. How might you suggest that you can change that? What would make a really impactful change for you and the colleagues that you work with in terms of those structures, the funding structures? You know, what does that look like?
First of all, there's a lot of waste in the NHS. You know, in me and my group, I've never had more staff than I currently do. And my emergency department has never had more doctors in it and never had more nurses in it. Yet I'm not able to necessarily achieve what I want to achieve. Part of that's a space issue. And part of that is we haven't quite got the resource in the right place. So we will have pockets within the NHS with quite good resource and pockets where resource is quite scarce. We often, I think, can end up developing a service over here that requires a bit of resource, and rather than think about pulling the resource from somewhere else that might already have it, bolt it on, and then that will leave somewhere else with an inability to access what is essentially one pot of money. I think longer term, that there's probably three things that I think the NHS needs to get right. One is right sizing the number of acute beds. So an acute bed is a bed in a hospital. Most new hospitals that get built replace old hospitals, and they replace them with fewer numbers of beds than the old hospital had before. That is fine, provided your services become more efficient and your length of stay for each patient goes down. If that doesn't happen, all that does is remove beds from a system. So right sizing the number of acute beds, I think, is quite important. And there's quite a lot of variation across the country. Some hospitals will have relatively higher numbers of beds than others, but I doubt there's many people doing what I do that think that they've got enough. I think the next thing is to, and this is probably the most important, is to adequately resource social care. That's changed quite a lot in the time that I've been a doctor, although I've been increasingly aware of it in the time that I've been working in leadership positions. If we don't have adequate provision of social care in the UK, and if we don't pay social care staff well enough and reward that as a career in terms of their development to make sure that we're recruiting into those posts, then what will happen is inadequate provision of social care, be it in care homes, nursing homes, or care that might come into your house, it's not available, and then patients will back up into hospital as a result. So I think that's the problem here. And if you get paid more to work in a supermarket than you do to look after our elderly relatives in a care home, then we're going to struggle to fill those spots. And then the final thing is a long-term workforce plan. we need to think about what does healthcare look like, not 5 years from now, but 20 years from now. Who do we need to train now to support that then? And if we get those three things right, then we're on easy street. But those are long-term goals.
It's always good to have a goal to aim for, I guess. But how to get there is tough when you have changing strategies centrally from sort of governments and changes of governments that have been happening, especially over the last sort of 7-8 years, quite frequently. And you've got a changing population as well. How much of those two factors, a changing population and changing government, how much are they a causal factor for the difficulties that the NHS is facing?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. The predominance of my career has worked under one form of government. I think there's two different ways, really. So the NHS is a huge organisation. You know, hundreds of thousands, I think it's millions of people work in the NHS. And get that right, it's really powerful. In terms of procurement, you know, the NHS could really, through coordination, save so much money on effective procurement. In terms of data, the amount of data that's available within the NHS, although it's not particularly well shared between different parts sometimes, that is hugely useful in advancing healthcare and planning. The larger the organisation, though, the less agile it can become. I think the more bureaucracy that often then we perhaps have a habit of falling into, and as a result, I think organisations could become more risk averse. A small NHS that functions as a series of smaller units that fit together, reporting to one rather than too much top down, I think that does promote better local service development. It allows you to be more agile. You can develop a service in Coventry and Warwickshire because you need it in that place, not because somebody in Berkshire requires it for their patients. Yeah, it can be ultimately more productive, but I think then you lose perhaps some of the gains that are to be had around procurement, around workforce, around data sharing.
I want to just go to the population changes that we've seen in the country over, you know, continuing, and it just always has been a changing population, especially over the last 100 years, or at least the whole of the time the NHS in its 75-year history has been here. How much is our changing population and the demographics of our population impacting your services and sort of somewhat causing some of the barriers that you have?
It's quite a lot of work in the moment in the NHS to understand and tackle health inequalities. You still have cities where on one end of a bus route, your life expectancy will be 10 years less than on the other end of the bus route. And that's quite stark. And I think understanding the impact of that on the health service is really important. And then also planning health services to combat that. Should we be considering health inequality when we are, for example, managing waiting lists or providing care in a hospital? And I think there's a strong argument to do that. I think the NHS should play an active role in tackling health inequality through effective understanding of public health, through understanding their local communities, and then accordingly planning services.
And those services, talk to me about preventative services for the NHS to facilitate versus treatment. You know, how much do you put a weight on either of those to help you solve some of the issues? And also, in terms of those three things that you think needs to be affected, how much can focusing on preventative versus treatment influence that?
I think hugely, but it's very long term. So we... Before, you know, if we can have a population that has access to affordable, nutritious food, that has exercise embedded in daily activity, that has a reduction in smoking and reduction in alcohol rates, then we're ultimately going to have a population that has a lesser need on healthcare. And that, for me, is key to sustaining the NHS long term, is having a healthier population. It's not sexy to invest in. And it's not it doesn't solve the crisis of, you know, the headline on a Friday night of patients waiting 12 hours in an A&E or waiting 6 hours on an ambulance outside of an emergency department somewhere, which is a part of the day-to-day of people doing the sorts of jobs that I do, isn't solved by a greater understanding of what's in your diet or an increase in the age to buy cigarettes. But ultimately, we have to do that if we want to achieve a better experience within healthcare for everybody. We've seen some changes. Smoking rates are going down, aren't they? And as a consequence, the sorts of patients that I see with smoking-related illnesses, I think, is probably getting better. Alcohol rates in this country are pretty high, I think, you know, compared to other cultures. I think the British relationship with alcohol is not necessarily the most healthy. And I think that's probably something which ultimately is quite a drain on resource to the NHS, both in terms of direct harm to health and then the other things that go with it. You know, I see a lot of alcohol-related injuries, probably on a Friday or Saturday night in A&E. You know, a good proportion, 25% of the patients that we will see will have alcohol a factor in what it is that they've come in with. Homelessness as well. Certainly through the time that I've been working, there's been patterns where we've seen very little homelessness, and we have then periods of time where we see a lot more homelessness. And this is a group of patients that will always access their care through emergency departments. And so we then have to look at how we are promoting good health and promoting and helping people with things like homelessness to get to access the social support they require to allow them to lead a healthier lifestyle.
You mentioned two factors there, that, you know, causal factors for people that you might see: alcohol, tobacco. I believe they're two of the four that were presented by in a paper in The Lancet, two of the four factors that, you know, significantly affect the NHS. So the other two, as it was coined, ultra-processed foods, or let's just say sort of like low nutritious foods, and also fossil fuels in terms of the influence on the air quality. And what that paper did is it linked those four factors actually to business and to industry being factors that can either cause or influence that, and also the places where we can see the changes could occur. But what's the NHS's role, do you think, going forward in the preventative space for example, tobacco, alcohol, nutritious foods, and improving air quality or reduction in fossil fuels?
There's an awful lot of NHS resources is spent sorting out the effects of these things. Nowhere near enough is spent sorting out the preventing the disease occur through exposure. I think with things like smoking and alcohol, one of the key things that needs to happen is making every contact count. So it is making sure that we are calling out hazardous alcohol use when we see it in a compassionate way, signposting patients to effective resources or effective support to try and reduce things like their alcohol use. And then when they need professional support with that, making sure that that support is something which they can access, that is something that they can get on with, something that they can engage with, and something that they can that ultimately works to get them better. That requires investment in the right places. There will be people who've got problems with alcohol or smoking who have been changed by receiving a leaflet, but perhaps that is sometimes a cost-effective intervention rather than the sorts of things which would lead to meaningful change. So I think the voice of the NHS around improving public health needs to be heard when we're doing things like planning our cities. It needs to be heard when we're doing things like planning the diets of our children, you know, within school, things like this. We should be, if we know that things like ultra-processed foods are leading to health problems, then obviously an NHS organisation should be an exemplar when it comes to providing its patients and staff with nutritious and high quality food when they're on the premises, but also should be an advocate for people who aren't on the premises to access those foods in their community.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just want to ask you something on the making every contact count ideas. You know, whenever you get that contact with member of the public with a patient that you're looking to see how best you can support them with their health, maybe adjacent to the particular issue they come to you with. How is that received by staff? You know, I'm interested as to whether that's sort of squeezing more from them, and that's actually, you know, is that part of the difficulties that are faced? It feels like there's even more burdens, more pressures, two words I've used, you might use different ones, but that they experience in their role. I just wondered if you've heard anything about that at all.
I think it could be done badly. You know, if it becomes a checklist on admission, how much do you drink? Have you considered stopping? Do you have a gambling issue? These sorts of things. Then how impactful is that? However, if a tool like that can then identify a group of people using a service that perhaps are at a higher risk, then it's worth resourcing an intervention that then can go to that group. And this intervention is probably people that can then go to that group and have more in-depth conversations about how these things might be starting to take over parts of their life. It's understanding the emotional driven case for change with those individuals. You know, how much are you spending on this? How much is this affecting your family? How much is this affecting your work? Are there things that you could do to cut down? And doing that in a meaningful way. And there are organisations that do this really well, but often they're not directly funded by the NHS. They'll be charitable organisations or volunteer organisations. And that's wonderful that these services often serve a small part of a local population, rather than the population as a whole, which then, if we don't get that right, and if we don't try and bring all of these services together and understand what's offered all over the place, can then worsen inequality rather than improve it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, before I take us to the future and a future vision, I just want to ask something. You know, since 2022, the NHS has seen unprecedented strikes from its colleagues, you know, junior doctors, consultants, ambulance staff, nurses, quite famously for the first time. What are the impacts of those strikes that you've seen in your work?
I think the strikes have been challenging. I think when they first started, you know, we planned for the first strike with a bit of a panic as to, crikey, how are we going to manage to sustain the service, hoping that that first strike would be the last strike. And then, of course, they've rolled on, particularly in the junior doctors case, and we're still preparing for strikes at the moment. And actually, I'm due to work this weekend to help cover for our striking postgraduate doctors. From a managerial position, they're challenging. It's a distraction. They are expensive for the acute trusts. Many trusts are spending millions of pounds making contingencies to keep care going over the strikes. There will be patients whose experience is poor as a result, where they've been expecting something to happen and then that thing has to be cancelled to maintain a service elsewhere. From a leadership position, they've been interesting. It's clear that across the workforce, there's a real breadth of feeling about the strikes. And I think sometimes I've been in rooms where it feels like no two people in the room have the same opinion about the strikes. And so from a leadership position, then trying to actually direct a team towards the preferred outcome and to maintain the sorts of levels of patient care that we want to set out and deliver is challenging because you're balancing a range of opinions. I think the issues are really important. I think a resolution, particularly in the postgraduate doctors, the junior doctors strike, as it's known, is really needed. We haven't had that yet. It's something that I'm really looking forward to. I've got a huge amount of sympathy for the junior doctors who are striking. And I've also got a huge amount of sympathy for the patients who are struggling to access care as a result. Sum up in one word, challenging.
Yes, I can imagine. Can you suggest at all where the solution comes? Is there anything that you can say?
Conflict has to end in some kind of compromise and discussion. I don't think any meaningful conflict ends effectively when two sides become entrenched in a position. And that's not just an industrial action, that's probably anything, isn't it? So I think it has to, cooperation, collaboration, and working together to find a common ground is really important. And I'm not close to any of the negotiations, and I recognise the strength of feeling, but it's a situation which is ultimately financially unsustainable, operationally unsustainable, without really impacting our abilities to look after our patients who need planned care. You know, whenever you've got an argument, getting two sides around a table and talking about it is really the only way forward.
Yeah, well, let's hope there's some solution for everyone soon with that. Just thinking about the future now, the NHS, 75 years old plus now, you know, formed in the summer of 1948, and it's functioned amazingly, quite, you know, uniquely for that period of time, providing free to access healthcare. But you know, if it was a human, 75 years, you're thinking about, actually, if you're 75 years old, you're on your last era of your life, things might not work as quite as well as they did do 30, 40 years ago. And we ultimately know what happens to humans at some point in that process. Is that where the NHS is going, or have you got a vision of how healthcare, the NHS healthcare, can change and adapt over the course of the next 75 years?
I'm a huge supporter of public healthcare. I think in countries and in systems where public healthcare is not an option, there are a lot of losers. And I ideally hope the NHS survives. It's got a huge amount of public support, but it can't survive without changing. There's no doubt there's waste in the NHS. You know, you'll experience it if you go to your doctor or your physio, or you go to a hospital appointment. On the most basic level, you'll probably be asked the same thing about four times. You'll probably be asked to move around between different parts of the department without clearly knowing why. There'll be bits of information or tests done that don't really add value to what you're doing. And frankly, if you were paying for it, you wouldn't feel like you wanted to for some of it. And I think we need to learn from other sectors on some of this stuff. I think that's getting better. You know, we're learning a lot about quality improvement from industry. We're learning a lot about safety from the aviation industry. And I think those sorts of things have to come, because we can't just keep on doing the same thing we've always done in this sort of paternalistic, wasteful way and expect the public to tolerate a service which will otherwise just get worse and worse. I think a lot can be done through utilising effective quality improvement within healthcare. There are some big decisions to make. You know, it's common now for NHS providers to use private healthcare for certain things. Patients will not turn to private healthcare in huge numbers. It's still a small percentage, but it's there. However, the private healthcare will often treat the simpler cases or the higher volume, lower acuity cases. The emergency complications of those are dealt with by the NHS. The complicated stuff that requires a whole multidisciplinary team is often something that's dealt with by the NHS. And I think we need to think about that, because otherwise it's just money leaving the NHS, with the NHS picking up consequences. There's something there. I think legislation can help reduce some of the money. It is all about money in my head. The legislation can help. I remember when I started in A&E, it was really common for us to see patients coming in with whiplash. We'd see it maybe 10 times a day. We'd have somebody involved in a low-risk car accident coming in with some neck pain for whiplash. And then I spent a bit of time working in New Zealand. I went to work in Christchurch, and I noticed over there I didn't see a single patient with whiplash. It's still a big city. People still had low speed shunts at roundabouts and things. The reason why, as far as I could understand it, was that in New Zealand, if you had a car accident and you developed some soft tissue neck pain, it was an accident, and therefore you didn't get any compensation. It was an accident. It wasn't anybody's fault. And meanwhile, in this country at that time, we were, a lot of money was going out of, ultimately out of the public purse to recompense people for low energy and fairly inconsequential injuries a lot of the time. Legislation changed a few years ago, and as a result, we very rarely see whiplash now coming to the A&E. And I think it's simply a matter of it's harder to claim, and the claims don't get valued in the same way. You don't get your legal fees paid or whatever it is. But as a result, money doesn't leave. I think there's something in legislation, the rest of it. A lot of A&Es will medical negligence and mistakes, when they occur, should absolutely be looked at, and patients should be rewarded where they become financially penalised. But the money that leaves the NHS as a result of some of these claims might be £25 per A&E attendance per year. If you've got an A&E that sees 100,000 people, that's a lot of money. Now, absolutely, where mistakes are made or where somebody requires longer term support, the funding should be available for them to receive that. But the whiplash thing is an area where legislation has reduced the amount of money that leaves the public purse. I think we need to look at some of that sort of stuff. The NHS, I only have the opinion that it should survive. I think a lot of harm will be done if it breaks down. I think before we look at purchasing private healthcare for NHS patients, we should be relentlessly reducing the waste within our own NHS services and seeing what resources we can save. And then we should be looking to support from central government around things like legislation that can promote money staying within the service rather than money leaving the NHS. I guess that's where I stand on it. I'm fairly hopeful. One of the reasons I chose to do A&E, though, is because you don't get private A&Es. You have a heart attack. You can't tell your ambulance to take you to the Bupa for a private A&E. It doesn't work like that. And one of the things I enjoy about emergency medicine and why I chose to do what I do is because all of my clinical work is NHS. So perhaps I represent a view to one side of a bell-shaped curve, but that's, I guess, it's my opinion.
And just to finish that, your opinion off, what about AI? The term of 2023-24, has AI got a space in the NHS, or is it going to be something that if it does, it's going to come in 20 years time? It's not something that's going to come in tomorrow.
No, it needs to come in, and we need to be ready for it, and we need to be more agile to accept it and welcome it quicker than we have been with pretty much every other technological solution. It's totally foreseeable, isn't it, that a CT scanner could automatically interpret the pictures that go through it, removing the need for a radiologist to review every single one. It's totally possible. You're probably familiar with 111, which is the non-emergency helpline you can phone for health advice. And it's really algorithmic. Now, that could totally be supported by artificial intelligence and perhaps then bring patients into the right place first time rather than spitting out a destination where they'll go to, and then 9 times out of 10 they might need to then move on somewhere else. We've got to get the basic electronic stuff right first. It's very common in a lot of hospitals that you still, everything's written down on paper. You're not even putting in your own name and date of birth to book in the system. You're still manually giving that to receptionists. But absolutely AI. And AI not just in the interpretation of results or they're helping to stream and direct patients to the right part of care, but also helping us to predict what our need is. AI could there's huge amounts of data within the NHS. Appropriate analysis of that data could surely help me target my emergency care delivery 5 years hence, 10 years hence, the sorts of conditions that I might start to see. Do I need more provision of mental health? Do I need more cardiology provision? Do I need more metabolic medicine provision? Do we need more or do we need less orthopedic or general surgery, etc.? We're just scratching the surface, I think.
Yeah, I can see how the efficiencies can can come in. So we'll watch this space. As we just wrap up now then, firstly, where can people find you if they, you know, want to get in touch, or maybe some of the things you've been talking about today? Is there any place that you know that people can go to access either of those things?
So people can contact me. I'm on Twitter. I think it's at Dr. Ed Hartley. There's a lot of sensible people talking a lot of sensible stuff. You know, I think some of the stuff that comes out of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine is hugely sensible in terms of describing to patients the experiences that they might have in A&Es at the moment. I think there's a number of think tanks, aren't there, that provide some really interesting information. King's Fund, Nuffield being one of those. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, before we let you go, and I said we're really appreciative of your time today, but if you were going to talk to someone who was thinking about studying medicine, going into working within the NHS, either as a sort of healthcare practitioner or as a someone supporting the direct primary healthcare practitioners, what would you say to them? Why is what you do still an attractive and a good avenue and direction to go down?
I love my job. I think I went into medicine because at 18 I was quite good at science and I liked talking to people and I didn't find school that difficult and it felt like a reasonable degree, but I didn't really know what a doctor did probably until I finished my medical degree. I've stayed in it because it gives me a huge amount of personal reward. The wonderful thing about medicine is whatever your personality type, there's a career in it for you. To do what I do in A&E, I have to be really comfortable with risk. You know, I have to be comfortable sometimes sending patients home, not really knowing what's wrong with them, but trying to work out, okay, am I concerned that this might get worse, or am I comfortable that this is probably something that's going to get better? I will often have lots of things to do at once. I might have 80 patients in the emergency department, have to be involved in the management of all of them to some degree. And that suits me. I never know what I'm going to do until the day that I do it from a clinical job. It's brilliant. And I see old people, young people with all sorts of presentations. In fact, if I was somebody who found doing more than one thing at a time stressful, or if I was somebody who required a high degree of certainty about the decisions I was going to make, then there's a specialty out there for them as well. It's probably not emergency medicine. You find that quite tiring, but there are, whatever your personality type, you know, highly specialised in a technical skill, or really want to work with children and young people, or really sympathetic about those with addiction issues and with deep entrenched psychological problems, there's specialties out there for them. When you come in terms of medical leadership, which is sort of a path I've fallen into, that's a total accident. You know, you become a doctor because you're good at exams. You become a consultant because you're good at exams. You know, you put the hours in, you do the assessments at work. And then once you become a consultant, suddenly a significant chunk of your time is management, of which you've got no training. So you're an absolute toddler at that. And I found that I enjoyed that bit a lot. I enjoy the clinical governance, making sure my services are as safe as possible. I enjoy the service development. If we can set up something that improves the care for 40,000 people that use it a year, that's a big win. There's a lot of careers where you can end up in a leadership position. I think within medicine, you've got a real opportunity to affect positive change.
Well, this has been a fantastic podcast. Thank you again so much for your time and coming on. You know, really, really appreciate it. Thanks, Ed.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. And thank you very much for joining us today. If you've liked what we've talked about today, then feel free to like or subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. And you can also visit our sister podcast, Experts in Sport, and you can find a link to that in the show notes. So that just leaves me to say once again, thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to welcoming you back to another health-focused podcast in a future episode. Bye-bye for now.